But
here we are again. What is it, November
17th.
Wow, time flies. And
2014.
And we're off.
Well, the last time I had just experienced the most painful night of my life, before or since. And I took a mighty vow that I wouldn't let it defeat me. So I went right back to being the director of research for AWOC on the very next day and continued to keep busy. As a matter of fact, surprisingly enough, I found myself being busier than I ever had been before. Just a combination of circumstances, I suppose. But there were a number of public hearings by state and federal agencies which seemed to become interested in the fact that there was a problem in farm labor. And somebody had to testify at these hearings. So sometimes I would prepare testimony, sometimes I would write testimony for Norman Smith, who would appear all right but didn't pay any attention to the script in front of him. And there were other times in which the PR director for AWOC, Lou Cranock, would testify, and he would pay pretty close attention to what he had in front of him. So that was one of my activities.
Were these hearings about the Bracero program in particular? Or?
No, these were hearings about things like whether farm workers should have a minimum wage and whether they might be covered by unemployment insurance, this kind of thing.
Domestic farm.
Looking forward to the fact that the Bracero program wouldn't last forever. I'm talking now about a period of about 6 months, the last half of 1960. The following year, there were once again hearings on the subject of renewing the Bracero program. But I'm talking about the 6 months immediately following that horrible evening of June 30th, 1960. Another one of the developments was that I, because of the force of circumstances, found myself needing to make more common trips to Berkeley than I had for some time. I had been rather out of touch since I had come to a parting of the ways with the School of Public Health. I had rather lost touch with developments in the student body at UC Berkeley. And I was going to Berkeley more frequently than I had for quite a while because of the fact that that is where my three kids were now located. They began by spending some time in San Jose with their grandparents, but they were living in an apartment, I think on Milvia Street.
Yep, I remember that apartment.
It was very close to Whittier School, which was the school for bright kids in the Berkeley system. Um, So I got back in touch with an old associate of mine named Fritjof Tigerson. I think I've mentioned him in the past, because he's the fellow who was very active in the world government movement, who introduced me to Pamela Enderton in the first place. He was now very active in Berkeley student politics. And off campus, he was also very active in the Socialist Party. And he had the charm to lure a bird out of a bush, as we used to say in Texas. So he recruited me into joining the Socialist Party. And I also helped with the organization of an on-campus group called Students Committee for Agricultural Labor, with the acronym SCAL. And I would sometimes speak at their meetings, and on other occasions I would recruit bona fide farm workers to speak to them. And sometimes we would have work parties in Stockton, in which they would come out on weekends and see how life was really lived in the lower classes. I would also point out that the year 2000 was another presidential election year. And it was...
You mean 1960?
I mean 1960. It was a more than normal interest, because the Democratic nominee was a young senator named John F. Kennedy. And the Republican nominee was the sitting vice president of the country named Richard Nixon. I had been following his career for a long time, because he got a start in politics as a congressman from the district in which Pomona College was located. So he was the congressman right after the war, when I was returning to Pomona, having served, if that's the right word, in the Army for a little while. And Nixon won his first term in Congress with a telephone campaign in which he would call Democrats to ask them if they knew that their candidate was a communist. And they didn't know any such thing, because, of course, there wasn't a word of truth in it. He was actually he was very active in the co-op movement. That was his claim to fame. He was a good man. Anyway, needless to say, I was not for Nixon, but neither could I bring myself to be in favor of JFK because he had a bad record when it came to the issue in which I was most interested, namely equal rights for farm workers. He had a bad record on that. His principal advisor in agriculture matters was a Southern Dixiecrat from Florida. Now I think we have, there he is.
Did I miss anything?
You didn't miss much.
Okay.
I was just, we don't have our water glasses yet.
No, and I are going to go get dinner. We'll be back.
Okay, we'll see you later.
You want this?
Thank you. I was talking about the period that followed the night of June 30th, 1960, when I came home from my job with AWOC one night to find the house dark and vacant. And how I promised myself not to let my personal problems with my wife and mother of my three children at the time, not to let it defeat me. And I vowed to keep going on my path in which I was trying to make myself useful to the movement for farm worker justice. And I was in the middle of commenting on the presidential election of that year, in which the candidates were John F. Kennedy for the Democrats and Richard Nixon for the Republicans. Nixon was a sworn enemy of the farm worker movement, and JFK was no friend of the movement because he had been listening to a fellow senator, a personal friend of his from Florida, who had convinced him that the Bracero program was a necessity of life for growers. And so I couldn't vote for either Nixon or Kennedy. I was all set to vote for Norman Thomas. But when I showed up to vote on election day in a precinct near where we had been living, the precinct watcher, who was an elderly woman who apparently made a career out of keeping track of where everybody was living at all times. And she knew, I don't know how she knew, but she knew that I was not still living at 1840 Ramona Avenue, which for me was a haunted house, and I had nothing to do with it. I can't remember whether it was being rented out or whether I had sold it.
Okay.
Whatever had been done with it, my mother had taken it over because she was very experienced right. with real estate matters at that time. So I couldn't vote. In fact, in modern parlance, I was a homeless person. I didn't have any permanent residence at that time. I was sleeping on the floor as long as I was in Stockton. I was sleeping on the floor of my boss, mm-hmm. Norman Smith. And then there were the times that I was in Berkeley getting what visitation I was allowed to have with my children. And I didn't have a place to live there. Among other things, I couldn't afford it because I was following my mother's advice that there was hope for me to get back together with my wife if I was very generous to her financially. And so, following my mother's advice, I was turning over virtually my entire AWOC paycheck to my ex-wife, because for all practical purposes, I knew that there was absolutely no chance that she was going to ever change her mind about her feelings toward me. But for a while, I was following my mother's advice just to please her. And so I couldn't have rented a place in Berkeley even if I'd wanted to. It was a matter of my having to scrounge for places I could visit with the kids. Mm-hmm. I made do with crashing with friends. I remember one place where a friend had an attic which he wasn't using, and so I would have the three kids up there even though there was no place to heat it. Very unsatisfactory. I also managed to crank out research papers. I made speaking engagements. I remember one particularly. I think it may have been arranged for me by Father McCullough. The National Council of Catholic Women were holding their annual convention in Las Vegas, of all places. It struck me as being singularly inappropriate for a religious organization because it is known as Sin City, right. With good reason. But Father McCullough wanted me to speak to the good ladies about the farm workers, their problems, and the fact that there was an organization called AWOC that was trying to deal with those problems. So I conceived the idea of making a presentation based upon some of the teachings of the Catholic Church itself, but not revealing the source of my quotations until the end of the talk. There were several papal encyclicals dating as far back as the year 1891, in which the popes had spoken on the rights of working men to organize in their own best interests. And the popes had figured out that it was not only a right, but an obligation as part of what they call the natural law. So I wove all this into my presentation, and at the very end revealed that I wasn't quoting any modern progressive left-wingers, but I was quoting the popes themselves. And then I got out of town as quickly as possible, because I hated Las Vegas. I hated the whole thing. There were right on the peripheries of the meeting place where they were holding this convention, there were, of course, slot machines all lined up for the ladies to waste their money as soon as they got through listening to speeches. I thought it was very unseemly. Anyway, time went by until January, when Norman Smith made what was probably the worst decision of his tenure. The United Packing House Workers Union which was having a very tough time because its packing house operations, which used to process fruits and vegetables in sheds under the roof against the elements, and under the ceiling of labor contracts, because the federal labor relations laws covered workers under the roof of places of employment, but it specifically excluded workers in the open, in the fields. Well, with the advent of the brucero system, the growers figured it out that it would be to their great advantage to shift the packing of fruits and vegetables from underneath a roof to the open air. They would pack the stuff in the fields by braceros. And the packing house workers union was becoming virtually defunct until, as a last gasp measure, they tried putting on a big strike in Imperial County of California. They were striking against the winter lettuce harvest, and the whole operation had been converted to the fields, and the Packing House Workers Union was going to try to take advantage of one of the clauses of the law under which the Bracero system operated, namely that they would never be used as strike breakers when a strike was in effect. So the packing house workers union went down there and declared a strike, even though by then all of their workers had left the area since their jobs no longer existed in the packing sheds. They had all been taken over in the fields. But the packing house workers union figured that if they could prove that they had even a minor presence in the county, mm-hmm. that they could legitimately call a strike, and that the government would have to recognize it as being legitimate and would therefore have to withdraw their permission to have Braceros cutting that lettuce. And Norman Smith was more than once heard to say, to complain, there's nothing to do around here during the winter, talking about Stockton. There were those of us, such as myself and Father McCullough and Dolores Huerta, as long as she was still on the scene, although during the fall of 59, she had given up hope in AWOC and had moved down to Southern California to work with Chavez. Mm-hmm. There were those of us who thought that the winter was, in fact, the very best time to start organizing farm workers in the most meaningful way, which is was to start with small groups, because in the winter there was nothing else for these guys to do except meet and start talking about their mutual problems and how to deal with them. So I was appalled that Smith didn't see the possibilities of making good use of the winter months. He ordered all of the AWOC staff to move down to Imperial County, including me. Well, I went down there just as an observer, and I was not at all surprised to find that the government agencies running the Bracero program were not greatly impressed by the packing house workers union claiming that with half a dozen members or whatever they had a bona fide strike in process. One of the reasons why they thought that they might get some traction was that the presidential election had brought JFK into office, and he had nominated as his Secretary of Labor the former General Counsel of the CIO. The CIO being the more liberal of the two big labor federations which had merged to make up the AFL-CIO. Mm-hmm. And His name was Arthur Goldberg, and there's no doubt that he was a good man in many respects, but he was new to the problems of the farm labor lobby. And that lobby brought out all its big guns and its lawyers and found all kinds of ways to argue over the definition of a labor dispute. When is it bona fide and when is it a sham? So they were able to stall him off for an extended period of time to prevent him from taking any action on withdrawing braceros from the lettuce fields. So then there was an element within the Packing House Workers Union, and also to an extent within the staff of AWOC itself, guys who were convinced that you have to fight fire with fire, whatever cliches they might want to use. You can't be a nice guy in fighting against the growers who have been known to use violence many times in the past. And so they began working on Smith himself and on the head of the packing house union in the area. I don't know whether those two guys ever gave their permission or whether these firebrands within their two staffs simply took it upon themselves. So one of the things that they did was to buy some dynamite and hide it in some particular place and then let it be known by the grapevine, so to speak, that's where it was. So the authorities found it, and were afraid that the union was planning to use it. And this really shook up the Mexican government, and the Mexican government began moving in ways that the US government didn't or couldn't or wouldn't. And to seal the deal, the union rank and file found a couple of guys who were willing to exercise physical violence against some braceros themselves. And according to my understanding, they ran through a couple of bracero barracks with broom handles and whacked some of the braceros against on the back with these broom handles. And that broke the camel's back. As far as the Mexican government was concerned, and they ordered the braceros in those barracks removed for their own safety. Well, It didn't really affect the harvest because they were not more than a probably 5 or 10% fraction of the total braceros in the county. But much more important, of course, was it did what it did to public opinion and what it did to the legal bills of the two unions involved. They were sued. There were arrests and imprisonments and long and expensive trials. Including a trial for the legal offense of conspiracy. I don't understand the ins and outs of it. But the charge of conspiracy to use that dynamite was as severe, if not more so, than if they had actually used it. Mm-hmm. Conspiracy is a really very serious crime. Mm-hmm. And Some of the guys spent a considerable amount of time in prison, but the main problem as far as the leadership of the AFL-CIO is the money fines and the cost of the lawyers that they had to hire to defend these guys. It ran into millions of dollars and went on and on. Now, the lettuce harvest was over probably in the latter part of February, with the unions accomplishing absolutely nothing. I don't think that the U.S. government agencies ever did use any of its powers to act in the case of a strike, so that whole issue remained unresolved during the remainder of the Bracero program. This was the early part of 1961. The program had 3 more years to run. Now, I went back to Stockton, wrote a couple of research papers, so-called, where they were actually more propaganda than research, but one was called Imperialism in Our Fields, a little play on the name Imperial County, and the other was called A Lot of Lettuce, a pun on the use of the word letters. Now, for reasons that I've never fully understood, it was about this time, maybe March of 61, that I was called in the Norman Smith's office and told that they had decided that I would make myself more useful with an assignment in Washington, D.C. as a kind of lobbyist. They were, I guess, familiar with my knowledge of the Bracero program from the research I had done for the university. And that I could make myself useful by going around to the offices of congressmen and senators to talk to them about the fact that the extension of Public Law 78, the enabling legislation for the Bracero program, it was going to be coming up again, and that they could use my persuasive powers, such as they were. So all this was totally out of the blue. At the time, I had no inkling. Later on, I had a theory of what was actually going on. So I went back to Washington with little more than a suitcase and once again I had to rely on the kindness of not strangers, the kindness of friends . There was a fellow that I had known at the University of California in Berkeley, who was very interested in the labor movement in general. And I helped him get a job with the Department of Labor in Washington. So, I was able to crash with him and his wife when I first got to Washington. There came a time when I outlived my welcome and found a boarding house where you could get a room and two meals a day, breakfast and dinner, for $25 a week, which was a spectacular bargain by California terms. But I learned that Washington is practically a different country. Washington, D.C., I mean. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a colony. Run by colonials, that is, Washington, D.C. is effectively run by Congress. And Congress at that time was effectively run by Southern Democrats who were very conservative. They were accustomed to cheap labor back in the states where they came from, and they expected and got cheap labor in Washington, D.C. Everything was cheap in Washington, D.C. by what I was accustomed to in the Bay Area, such as this $25 a week for a room and board. That was like finding money in the street as far as I was concerned. Taxis were very cheap because that's the mode of transportation that all the congressmen used. They didn't have a subway system at that time. So I got used to riding taxis for the first time in my life. Now, I come to some insight which I think is accurate and possibly I should go off the record, but I don't know how to operate that machine, so I'm going to have to leave it to whoever transcribes this later. I had begun keeping company with a girl or woman in Berkeley who was from the progressive wing of organizations and politics. In fact, I found that before she came to Berkeley, back I guess when she was a high schooler, she had been a member of an organization called the Young Pioneers, which was on the verboten list of the Attorney General as being communist dominated. By the time I knew her, I didn't know anybody who still believed that the Soviet Union was the source of any kind of liberation. But quite the contrary. But the AFL-CIO was of a different mind. They were so fearful of McCarthyism, which would blacken them with the tar brush, if they had anything to do with anybody who at any time in the past, no matter how distant, had been a card-carrying member of one of these verboten organizations. Now, the reason why Norman Smith all of a sudden had the idea of sending me to Washington, D.C. is that he was told to do so because the higher-ups above him, through some kind of system, I don't know how they knew, but they knew that I had been seeing this young lady. And they thought that by sending me to Washington, D.C., would make it impossible for me to continue seeing her. Well, since I didn't know that all this was operating in the background, I got lonely in this boarding house where I didn't know anybody. And so I sent for my friend. And we began sharing a room. Even at $50 a week, it was still a bargain. But the the underground information system, however it worked, found out about this, of course, and after a very short period of time, maybe a couple of weeks at the most, I got a telegram from Norman Smith ordering me to report back to Stockton within 72 hours or something like that. I still didn't know why. But I moved swiftly, found another guy working in the AFL-CIO headquarters that had an old clunker of a car that he wanted to sell for $180. So I bought that clunker, and started driving west. With my friend and our belongings, which weren't very extensive, everything fitted into this one car. And we made it back to Stockton within 72 hours by driving about 12 hours every day, maybe more than that. I drove a lot.
Yeah, give or take more than 12 hours in a day to go.
Okay.
In 72, but anyway.
I don't know how I did it. I don't know why Norman Smith never leveled with me I think he personally was probably not proud of this paranoia on the part of his superiors, because in fact McCarthyism had been discredited. It had its heyday back in the early 1950s for a couple of years. But then McCarthy himself was expelled from the U.S. Senate. In any case, I continued living in a fool's paradise and continued associating with this woman . But then there was another turn in the road. In June of 1961, George Meany, the head of the whole show, decided that he had had enough of Smith's misadventures and he cut off any funding for AWOC. I suppose that he thought that it would shrivel and die on the vine. Nothing was said, apparently, about the dues that Smith had been collecting for a couple of years, mostly from unfortunates on Skid Row, many of which I have every reason to believe he himself was paying out of his own pocket. In any case, some money was being put into a trust fund. And Smith was being allowed to use that up, even though he wasn't getting anything over and above that from the national organization, which is what he had been doing for a couple of years. Well, Smith still took a certain liking to me, so he said that he would keep me on. And he would keep on his personal secretary type up his letters and answer the telephone and so forth and so on. I guess he would continue paying a nominal rent on the building. I don't think I've ever mentioned the accommodations that AWOC had. They were almost palatial by comparison with the operation as a whole. It was a beautiful three-story brick building, which had been the labor temple for the entire county of San Joaquin. And for some reason, and you'll never be able to explain to me why, the movers and shakers of that county organization decided that they would do better with something more modern on the outskirts of town. This wasn't in the best part of town, but it was a heck of a good building. And it had been sitting vacant for some extended period of time when AWOC came into existence. And I think that they rented it to AWOC for some almost nominal sum. Of course, AWOC had to pay insurance, and I suppose there were some taxes, utilities, and so forth. So all of that was allowed to continue, but without any staff. No organizers were left. But they hadn't been doing any very meaningful organizing anyway, so it it opened up what I will call the volunteer period. And I don't know whether I want to begin with that, because it is quite a departure from everything that has gone before. And I think it's unfortunate that David can't be here. So if it's all the same with you, we may end a little earlier than usual tonight.
It's fine. It's fine.
We can talk among ourselves about other things. Do you have any thoughts about that plan to buy a black rubber tube for the ranch?
Oh, well, you don't need to.
I don't know how to
record this.
I don't know how to turn it off.
I'll figure it out somehow. It's probably pretty easy. I'm guessing. I press this.